This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. The consequences of crime can be severe, and they go beyond the sentence handed down by the judge. While the offender clearly understands the terms of the sentence, the other consequences often come as an unwelcome surprise. You can lose your home, your ability to get certain jobs, and your access to higher education. These unseen penalties make it harder for those convicted of crimes to get back on the straight and narrow. Two lawyers wanted to change all that. They created CCAT, Collateral Consequences Assessment Tool. It's a searchable database that gives anybody access to the full list of penalties that apply when you've committed a crime. And we have the co-managers of CCAT with us in the studio. Whitney Fairbanks is a civil defense educator with the UNC School of Government, and Daryl Atkinson is a staff attorney at the Southern Coalition for Social Justice. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here.
Good to be here.
Great to be here.
So, Whitney, there's this myth out there, I guess, that once you've completed your sentence, you've repaid your debt to society. But that's not true, is it?
No. Frank, in fact, I think it is a huge myth. It's a prevailing myth. It's been out there for a long time. But, in fact, there are, in North Carolina alone, literally thousands of what we refer to as collateral consequences that attach once a person even becomes involved with the criminal justice system. So it doesn't necessarily require a conviction to trigger some of these consequences.
Well, Daryl, that's true? You mean just an arrest? And so what happens then? What are some of the consequences, even if you haven't been convicted?
You can be kicked out of your public housing or lose your Section 8 voucher.
Just for being accused of a crime?
Yeah, just for being accused of a crime. Some of the other consequences that are more triggered on indictments and convictions. You could use your food stamp benefits. You can lose occupational and employment opportunities. And you can lose your right to vote. In fact, the Brennan Center and the Sentencing Project recently did a study, and they found that 5.3 million people will not be able to cast a ballot in the upcoming election because of felon disenfranchisement laws.
Now, wait a minute. Why? I thought that in the state of North Carolina, once you served your sentence, you can vote. Am I wrong about that?
You're correct, but sentence includes probation and parole. And probation, some of those periods can last up to 5 years. I think maximum term is sometimes 8 years. So people could actually be released from prison, be free walking around, contributing members to society in every other way, but be denied their right to cast a ballot.
And this is something of a tangent, but another problem is that there are people out there who think that just the fact that they've been convicted disqualifies them forever, and that's not true, but it also suppresses the vote to some extent.
That is true. And in North Carolina, disenfranchisement does not last forever, but there are states where it does. And I think that there's just a miscommunication or a misunderstanding of the law. Once you've completed your sentence in North Carolina, your right to vote is restored.
So what are some of these other consequences then that we might not have thought about? I mean, maybe you've given me the top 10, so give me the top 20.
Well, I think the ones we think about, the ones we know, are you lose your driver's license if you're convicted of driving while impaired. If you're convicted of certain sex offenses, you may have to register as a sex offender. But what people don't know is that collateral consequences affect virtually every area of, say, citizenship. And that's how we organized our database around these areas. So in employment, you can be barred from working as a barber if you're convicted of certain crimes. You can be barred from receiving a CDL. You can be barred from obtaining or keeping your license to practice law.
Let's go over a couple of those. What are the crimes that would keep you from becoming a barber?
I think one of the things to really point out for our listeners is that some of these consequences are automatic, meaning that they're mandatory, and others are discretionary, where you have to go before some administrative board, and they get to determine how relevant your criminal record history is. In North Carolina, the consequences are really triggered by categories of crime rather than specific crimes. So, for example, any felony, any misdemeanor, any crime of moral turpitude are some of the major categorical triggers that we found So more than specific obtaining property by false pretenses, for example, it's more any felony or any misdemeanor that will trigger a particular consequence.
And we should make a distinction here, and we're coming close to it. Some of them are in the legal code, and others are by association, professional associations. So if you want to become a lawyer, a doctor, a nurse, and you want to go in the medical profession, other professions then have their own standards. And they may apply them to your conviction.
I think that's a really good point. The collateral consequences are, I think, at best oblique. Our database, the collateral consequences assessment tool, deals strictly with the consequences that are contained in North Carolina law. So it includes the consequences found in statute and the consequences found in regulations. But it does not include any of these consequences that may be imposed by a professional board. It only includes those imposed by North Carolina law.
So depending on what field you were trying to pursue, these consequences could be more or less relevant. And also the fact that they're in the legal code, that you've noticed that the number of restrictions has grown quite a bit.
Sure. And I would dare say that we can really look at that increase as coinciding with our war on drugs, our war on crime, and us becoming much more punitive as a society. In the late 70s and 80s, we kind of discarded, you know, the paradigm of rehabilitation and really became much more retributive. And that retribution extended to these civil areas as well, and we really just wanted to punish people. And the impact of these consequences aren't evenly distributed across society because African Americans and Latinos have disproportionate contact with the criminal justice system. These consequences affect those communities more harshly.
And economically, it backfires, doesn't it? Because if I throw you out of your house, if I say that you don't have food stamp benefits and you're out of prison and you don't have a driver's license, I'm really limiting your ability to make a living, and there are only a few left to you. And there are a couple of professions that don't look at boards or requirements, and that might be just what got you in jail in the first place.
No, I think that's exactly right. And to me, it's a recipe for recidivism. You know, you've taken away the means where I can meet my basic needs, and people are going to go back to what they know. So if we really want to have more of a smart on crime paradigm rather than a tough on crime, we would think of more creative ways to mitigate the impact of these consequences or discard them, some of them altogether.
You actually made a presentation to the legislature about all of these consequences that have been accumulating over the time. Tell us about that presentation and the reaction that you got.
Yes. In December of 2009, I believe, John Rubin, who is a professor at the School of Government and who has served as kind of the faculty member mentor for this project, Daryl and I went to present to a subcommittee of the state legislature. I opened up the database, and which can be found, I would like to say this, at ccat.sog.unc.edu, and displayed a list of the consequences that affect employment rights alone. And there was an audible gasp. Someone in the room was so impressed by the length of the list, which at that time had over 700 jobs or professional descriptions that were impacted by consequences. So impressed that they gasped out loud.
But they gasped out loud at their work. This is what the legislature meant, not them in particular. Maybe they're freshmen. But the fact is, this is what this body's been doing over time. Is it accidental? How much of it is intentional? What do you think is behind all this, Daryl?
I would say not intentional from the perspective like we want to make sure people have no ability to reenter society. But the way that we legislate is very reactionary. Something bad happens, people come up with a law to fix it without really looking at what the aggregate impact will be. We think this tool will allow our state legislators to take a step back, look at the complete picture, and be better informed before they impose new consequences.
So, but Whitney, after the gasp, was there any indication that that's what they were going to do?
I think yes. this could be a little bit of a tangent, but we have seen new legislation in the last year in North Carolina that is kind of first step. Our legislature created what's called a certificate of relief. It allows people who have been convicted of certain crimes to apply to the district or superior court for relief from the collateral consequences of their conviction. It is fairly limited in scope, but it is certainly a recognition of the problem and that some people do not present the recidivist threat that others do, and that entry back into the workforce may be a way to reduce.
What got you interested in this? How did you first notice?
I was a public defender before I joined the School of Government. Certainly as a public defender here in Durham, met people who not only had to deal with had to pay their debt to society through the criminal justice system, what were kind of straddled with these consequences. And I worked with families who were involved in the justice system and daily spoke with social workers, very caring people who really wanted to help these families improve their lives, but were struggling to get around these barriers created by the consequences. So when I joined the School of Government, my boss said, "I would like you to meet this guy." And that was Daryl.
And I happen to be the guy.
had you been thinking about this up until that time?
For sure. And I had worked on a similar initiative in Minnesota where I went to law school. But what brought me to the work is that I'm a directly impacted person. I'm a person formerly incarcerated. I spent 40 months in prison in the Alabama Department of Corrections for a nonviolent drug crime. I consider myself a casualty of America's ill-conceived and highly racialized war on drugs. So I'm intimately familiar with collateral consequences. I've had to navigate these barriers. And out of that experience, you know, I came to find that these consequences in many ways were the true punishment. The 40 months was a blip on the radar screen of life, whereas many of these consequences are lifelong. For example, if I go back and move back to the state of Alabama, I can't vote, even though I'm licensed to practice law in both Minnesota and North Carolina. So many of these consequences have a lifelong effect, and I saw it as part of my professional calling, if you will, is to bring more transparency to this area of the law.
That's interesting, because I would have thought that that disbarment or the inability to make the bar would have been one of the consequences, that once you've been convicted of a felony, you couldn't be a lawyer. But I guess that's not true.
Well, that's a discretionary consequence. So if you can present enough evidence of rehabilitation to the Board of Law Examiners, you can be brought into the club.
So you say things are changing a little bit. There is some move on the part of the legislature, at least, to recognize that you should be able to apply for relief. Were you surprised at the number of legal consequences? Start with you, Whitney.
Yes. I think Daryl and I both expected there to be quite a few of them, and yet were shocked by the number once we really started digging into it. And one thing Daryl mentioned before is that we think the legislature has kind of created some of them in fits and starts, in response or in a reactionary way. So occasionally Daryl and I would be doing research and we'd have to pick up the phone and call one another and just kind of think about, I wonder what happened. I wonder how we got this law. So we weren't able to establish any real kind of pattern among the consequences, and we were shocked by the number of them. Daryl?
And what about it? Well, go ahead if you wanted to respond to that.
No, I think that's
because the excellent question I had for you is, in education, are you really barred from even sort of another? I mean, do colleges and universities pay attention to this, and can it have consequences for you there too?
Definitely. I personally experienced that. I applied to a number of different undergrads and wasn't accepted and faced the same kind of gatekeeper aspect when I applied to different law schools. And I also frequently interview clients who really feel that their criminal record history is being used against them and being accepted to various educational programs.
You know, when it comes to jobs, it's kind of an interesting problem right now. You've got 9% unemployment in this state, or pretty close to it, and it's hanging around there, not moving. We're at the point now where we're about to accept 7% unemployment as full employment. You're going to hear that very, very soon now. And when that happens, you've got 7% of the workforce unemployed. If you come to me with a felony record, that's an easy one. That's an easy way to filter when I know there's a huge body of unemployed people out there I can hire. I mean, it seems to me that that alone, and that's not legislated, that's at the discretion of the employer, can be a great barrier for reentry for folks coming back.
Definitely so. And employers, though, I think should be on notice that categorical bars could subject them to the purview of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, because the EEOC has put out recent guidance saying that using criminal record history as an absolute bar to someone getting a job could be a violation of Title VII, because it could have a disparate impact on African Americans and Latinos because they're disproportionately represented in the criminal justice system. So employers are encouraged to do what's called an individualized assessment of each particular applicant and not use it as an absolute screening mechanism.
Because you can imagine, I mean, if you're an employer who's worried about theft and somebody's been to jail three times for theft, that would be a factor that you should have the right to at least consider. But you're saying it can't be the only thing to consider.
It can't be the only thing. And I think you brought up an excellent point, Frank. One of the things employers should think about is what is the relationship between the underlying criminal offense and your prospective job. So you brought up the theft example, right? So if I've been convicted of embezzlement, maybe the comptroller or handling the finances for the company wouldn't be the best fit for me, because there's definitely a relationship between my past criminal behavior and prospective job. But in instances where that relationship doesn't exist, the criminal record is not nearly as relevant.
Tell us more about the toolkit itself. What do we find up there, and how can it be helpful to me?
I think that the tool, the collateral consequences assessment tool, could be helpful to you, to the citizens of North Carolina, to any number of people who are concerned, one, with understanding the law, and two, with understanding what consequences might bar them from participating in certain parts of their civic life or from certain employment or educational endeavors. We set it up in such a way to make this information that was spread throughout the North Carolina general statutes and really all over the general statutes and the regulations, set it up in a way that was that made it easy for just about anybody to get what they're interested in. So like I mentioned before, we noticed early on that consequences tend to affect certain areas of citizenship, employment, voting, public benefits, hunting, and wildlife. And we organized our database around these rights because people tend to be concerned about the rights that they exercise frequently. If I hunt, I want to know about wildlife consequences. If I'm a teacher, I want to know about public employment. So now anyone can go online to ccat.sog.unc.edu, and they can search either by the characteristics of the crime that triggers the offense, they can search by keyword, or they can search and browse through consequences that are organized around these broad categories of activities, privileges, and rights.
And I would think that attorneys might be interested in this for their client's sake. If you're about to do a plea agreement, you might want to take a look at what the consequences are, the collateral consequences.
No, that's an excellent point. And Whitney and I have done trainings for North Carolina public defenders on how to factor collateral consequences into their case strategy, how to use them in their plea negotiations, because we believe this isn't an us versus them kind of issue. If you present this information to prosecutors, right, they would be more than willing, I hope some of them, to think about what the collateral consequences may be, possibly lower the criminal sanction to maybe a lesser included offense that avoids the consequence. You still levied a punishment, but you haven't completely debilitated that person's ability to make a living, for example. And you've teed them up for reentering society.
I want to thank you both for being on the program today. Daryl Atkinson, staff attorney at the Southern Coalition for Social Justice. Whitney Fairbanks, civil defender, educator at the UNC School of Government. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you.
And to use the tool or learn more about it, go to ccat.sog.unc.edu. Up ahead, we're going to learn the art of cool from jazz musician Al Strong. Stay with us on The State of Things.